I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So we don't get Tim the Lawyer, as he was known when he was a regular caller on the Armstrong and Getty show many, many years ago. We don't get Tim the Lawyer, Tim Sandifer, in studio as much as we used to. But since you are in studio today, Tim Sandifer.
Yeah, I love what you've done with the place.
You are still bearded.
I am. You know, it's been 8 years that I've been had a beard, wow. And you ask me every time. Yeah.
What an idiot, you know?
And jeez. And you're not carrying a trash can sized
no
soda.
Yeah, I used to.
Like you used to.
I used to, and time caught up with me. I'm off carbonated beverages, I'm afraid.
Really?
Yeah. Couldn't take it anymore.
Happens to everybody.
Blew a gasket or something.
Congratulations on the beard and the soda.
Before we get into the substance of our conversation with Tim about his fabulous new tome and other constitutional issues in America, two things. Number one, and I think this will be good for you to hear. You know those warnings like on a McDonald's pie, the hot apple pie that says caution, content maybe hot, filling maybe hot? And we've always asked, who are those for? Well, they're for me. For the second day in a row, I've gotten a brand new hot cup of coffee, gotten into a brief conversation with somebody, then swigged down an enormous mouthful and burnt my tongue in my mouth and cried out in pain, fury, and humiliation. So those warnings are for me.
Gotcha.
I sympathize, man. I drew blood eating shrimp twice in a row a few weeks ago. It was how do you manage to? I cut my hand with shrimp tails at two separate meals on two successive days.
Wow.
Till there was blood running down my hand. How does somebody do that? I don't know, but yeah, I managed to do it.
I've never thought of prawns as a weapon.
Yeah, you're a lawyer. Why didn't you sue somebody?
Second thing, do you agree with Jack in my interpretation of the Eighth Amendment, its prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment? If something is merely cruel or merely unusual, like being berated by clowns, that would be unusual. It's permitted under the Eighth Amendment.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, that's all right.
So it's going to be cruel and unusual.
That's right.
Okay.
Right. So listen, I have intentionally, and it's taken some self-control, not looked up the name Jacob Bronowski. Tim's latest book, and Tim is the author of a number of absolutely fabulous books about constitutional rights and property rights, and fairly recently, Frederick Douglass, Self-Made Man, which is just terrific about that great, great American. So when I saw your new book is The Ascent of Jacob Bronowski, I've never heard of this human in my life. I intentionally did not look it up.
Sounds like a Coen Brothers character.
Yeah. Who is this human, and why did you take your valuable time to write a book about him?
I was looking for a subject that had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with law. And so I'm speaking today, later today at noon, I'm speaking to the Federalist Society about my new book, and the assignment is to find some way to relate it to law, which is going to be very challenging. But no.
So you need a subject you considered Moses Lack, but you decided this.
That's right. Well, his name is almost as exotic. Jacob Bronofsky was a scientist and philosopher who lived from 1908 to 1974, and those few people who remember him still today will remember him for his classic 1973 television miniseries, The Ascent of Man, which aired on PBS, and it's this lavish 13-hour documentary on the history of science. And I watched it when I was in college, and I got interested in Bronofsky himself, and it turned out that he was a fascinating person who knew everybody or was involved with everything interesting that happened in the 20th century.
Wow.
He was the head of the British mission sent to assess the effects of the atomic bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He was best friends with Leo Szilard, who invented the atomic bomb, but also with Samuel Beckett, who was the two of them wrote a book together. He was friends with people like T.S. Eliot and Dylan Thomas. He co-founded the Salk Institute in La Jolla with Jonas Salk. He was a fascinating guy. He wrote a radio play that won the equivalent of an Emmy in 1950. He wrote an opera. He proved that Australopithecus africanus is a human relative by using a sophisticated mathematical algorithm, because that was his specialty, was mathematics. And he revolutionized the understanding of the 18th century poet William Blake. So he was one of these Renaissance men who just was a fascinating figure, and I thought, nobody's ever written a biography of him, so I should.
Wow. It's interesting how some people, regularly when I'm reading history, and I do it all the time, you come across a story or a person and you think, how come I've never heard this before?
Yeah,
how come
right.
people, some things just get lost to history. Amazing people and amazing stories that just, for whatever reason, don't make the cut.
Right, the under-discussed and over-discussed. How much do we know about Marilyn Monroe?
one of his
contemporaries.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Compared to somebody.
Mickey Mantle, for that matter.
And Bronofsky was a celebrity in his day. He was a big enough name in Great Britain for 20 or 30 years that, you know, taxi drivers would hail him on the street. He's even mentioned in a Monty Python skit, The Exploding Penguin, when one character says to another, why is there a penguin on the telly? And the other says, who am I, Dr. Bloody Bronofsky? Because he was that well known.
Wow. I was totally wasted on me.
Funny.
The problem
That's
was
funny.
He died in August of 74, only months before his show aired in the United States.
Ah.
And so right when he was on the cusp of becoming a really famous figure in the United States, where he had lived for a decade by that time, he was gone. And so he vanished from the scene and everybody forgot about him. And I think that's a real shame. So I thought I decided to try and bring more interest to what he did and analyze his philosophical writing and his literary work and stuff. The problem was he was involved in so many things and knew so many things that it took a long time for me to learn enough about those things to be able to talk intelligently about it. So I've been working on this book for 20 years.
Wow.
Since I was a senior in college, and it is finally done and finally published, and it's called The Ascent of Jacob Bronofsky, and I hope you'll all buy it.
Speaking of getting published, was it difficult to go to somebody and say, I want to write about this person? They said, who? Can't you write about a founding father or something?
Fortunately.
How about a Lincoln book?
I found the publishers who did remember who Bronofsky was, and that worked out. But yeah, there was some difficulty in that a lot of the people that he knew are gone now. I did have the good fortune of interviewing some of them. The coolest one was I got to have lunch with Francis Crick, who won the Nobel Prize in the 1950s for discovering the structure of DNA.
Yeah.
The only Nobel Prize winner ever to buy me lunch. And that was by far the coolest part of the research.
And did you find the old chap to be stimulating?
Wonderfully.
It was
while the O.J. Simpson trial was going on, and I asked him what he thought about people ignoring DNA evidence in trials.
Oh,
and
wow.
He said, well, I guess you have to know how the American legal system works. And he had so much scorn in his voice when he said the word legal that I didn't mention that I was in law school at the time.
Yeah.
He was a wonderful, wonderful gentleman, and he, I remember very distinctly on the way back from the restaurant, him explaining to me the then newly discovered eyeless gene, which is the gene that if you knock it out, a fruit fly or whatever will be born without eyes. And this is one of the oldest genes in the genome. It's called a Hox gene. It's been around since the dawn of evolutionary time. And it's the same gene that we have in our own bodies to control the development of eyes in the embryo. So years later, I was reading a book about genetics and I ran across the discussion of the eyeless gene, I thought, wait a minute, that Francis Crick himself explained that to me. That That's a really amazing experience in my life.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely.
But Crick and Bernofsky were good friends. In fact, before his death, Crick was using the same office that Bernofsky had used down at the Salk Institute in San Diego.
This just flitted into my head. I'm like an eyed fruit fly in terms of my ability to pay attention. This just flitted into my head. When you get up in the morning, what do you check news wise, like for what's going on in the world? Like,
Twitter.
What's your first thing? Twitter.
That's it.
And then, like, how do you structure your feed?
How many people do you follow? Yeah.
I follow quite a lot of people. I don't remember, somewhere maybe 1,000, something like that.
What tends to be at the top of your list?
I follow 1,300.
Like, are they news publications or people?
People primarily. In fact, just this morning I was thinking of writing a tweet about who I would recommend for the Pulitzer Prize if I were in charge of the Pulitzer Prize, and the three names are John Ziegler, Elizabeth Nolan Brown at Reason, and Robbie Soave at Reason.
I love Robbie.
The three of them are the real journalists that are still working today. And, of course, Dan Walters, since I'm in Sacramento, I need to mention the only remaining journalist in the state of California.
Dan is legendary.
He's amazing.
He's one of the great clear-eyed writers about California.
I just wish his articles would be three or four times as long as they are.
Did you read the transcript of what the editor there at the New York Times said last week to his crowd?
Yes, I did.
It's just incredible where that might be the most important newspaper in the world, or at least formerly was, and the direction they're willing to go, it's troubling.
Expecting a newspaper that recently ran articles such as "Women in the Soviet Union had better sex under communism," and "The Soviet space program was better for women's equality." Expecting a newspaper, or even calling it a newspaper, when it runs articles like that, I think is excessive. I think the New York Times has clearly gone off the deep end into not just leftist partisanship, which, you know, is kind of expected in the media, but in the most extreme form of it. And the same is true of CNN. I mean, I love CNN, but it's like day after day, it's become a partisan enterprise. I can't
to the
stand
point
this.
Of absurdity to, in my opinion.
Very
I
much
mean,
so.
It's just you can't even take it seriously.
And it's as bad for the left as it is for the right.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Over time, of course, it is going to be. And it's surprising to me that people of that caliber. I assume you have to have some pretty good credentials to end up being in the newsroom at the New York Times.
I would hope, but I don't know. And
you're willing to abandon journalistic principles because you hate Trump so much.
And it's so cheap. It's so cheap and easy to do, to make everything be about Donald Trump. I mean, everybody who follows me on Twitter knows my views on the president, but it's so easy to just make it a series of not even accurate slams on the president day after day after day, instead of the kind of sophisticated, in-depth research and reporting that takes a lot of work and is sometimes very frustrating when you're doing it, because you have to fact check everything twice and three times. And when you see people who do it well, like the people I've mentioned, Elizabeth Brown and Robbie Soave and John Ziegler, it's a testament to the continuing art form.
There's no market for that, egghead.
You
shut
know
up.
That's true.
You
that's
may
true.
Have lunched with Crick, but I'm telling you to shut
that's
up.
That's actually true. In fact, well, it does relate. It relates to Bernofsky in the sense that I think there are people out there who have a hunger for the kind of sophisticated, intelligent discussion. It doesn't have to be egg-headed craziness, but something that has some degree of smarts to it.
Just
and Bernofsky
not,
was really good at that.
Not so. Idiotic.
Yeah,
why don't
right.
we start there?
Is that too much to ask?
Well, you believe in self-government. Do you think we've reached a point where we can't govern ourselves? Because there's not a hunger for people who take the time to figure out what's real, whether it fits with what you want it to be or not.
Are you talking about California or the nation?
The nation.
Okay, well, then, you know, I don't think we've reached bottom there. California, I don't know. I honestly, I'm really am pessimistic about the possibility of any kind of reform in California. I think California has gone so far in the direction of taking the easy, emotionalistic, sound good answer over hard realities, and is so unwilling to face reality that I think it's going to be a long, hard struggle before California is able to right itself. But, you know, I'm a pessimistic person. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, you talk to Tom McClintock, And he'll always say, oh, California, there's no reason in the world why California couldn't change tomorrow and become a, you know, a livable, thriving economy. But I don't buy it.
Well, why don't we talk about a couple of the big stories in the news today with Tim Sandifer, Vice President for Litigation at the Goldwater Institute. His new book, which sounds fascinating, is The Ascent of Jacob Bronofsky. More to come. Stay with us.
Armstrong and Getty. Armstrong and Getty Show.
You'd think we'd have something other than the Law and Order theme when we have lawyers on, but it's the best we can do on the Armstrong and Getty Show.
Get over it. Tim Sandifer is with us. Tim, the lawyer, vice president for litigation, the Goldwater Institute. His new book is The Ascent of Jacob Bronofsky, somebody I had heard of, but hadn't realized I'd heard of because I was familiar with The Ascent of Man. It sounds like absolutely a fascinating read about a fascinating guy. But to talk about some of the things that are in the news right now, again, though we are nationwide these days and happy to be, Cal Unicornia continues to make news, including the idea of letting children vote, beginning with 17-year-olds. Now, I know my way around a sentence. I know some pretty words, but you're way better than me. What do you think of extending the vote to teenagers?
Well, I part of me says let them because the teenagers aren't going to vote. I mean, every year it's the same thing. Every election is the same thing. It's rock the vote and get the young vote out and go register to vote and everything. And especially the Democrats get very excited about all this. And then they don't show up to vote because they got other things they're worried about. But as you've said, and I think it's totally true, is that the effort to round up people who are too young to know how the world works and get them to vote is very indicative of the worldview of those who are behind that effort. It's precisely because leftist political philosophy is so emotionally appealing, but is in fact both unworkable and, in the last analysis, immoral, that there's an effort to recruit people who have not had enough experience or education in the world to understand its shortcomings, because they'll inevitably vote for that goal.
So. Right, that which makes them feel good.
We got on the topic of being pessimistic, and I wonder how you're not pessimistic with a lot of what's going on, but you said your own book touches on that.
Yeah, well, Bronofsky was living at a time during the rise of the hippie movement. He was very worried about the rise of the hippie movement because he thought it was a reactionary, anti-technology, anti-progress ideology that really threatened to undermine the future of the West. Bronofsky himself was actually a socialist, but he was one of those old-fashioned technical progressive kind of socialists, not like a throwback anti-technology type. And he was very worried about this. And in fact, he talked about it in the last episode of The Ascent of Man. If you haven't seen this documentary, you really must. I think it's the best documentary ever
made.
Where
can I find it?
It's available on DVD.
And it holds up.
Yeah, very much so. The costumes are a little funny because it's 1973, but absolutely. And in the last episode, I mean, almost the entire episode was filmed as a spontaneous one-hour monologue by Bronofsky, because he was such a good speaker that he could just talk to the camera and they would write down what he said, and that was the book version of the documentary. Because he was so interesting. And he talks about this in the last episode, and he says, I have it here. He says, I am infinitely saddened to find myself suddenly surrounded in the West by a sense of a terrible loss of nerve and a retreat from knowledge into what? Into Zen Buddhism, into falsely profound questions about are we not just really animals at bottom, into extrasensory perception and mystery that do not lie along the line of what we are able to know if we devote ourselves to an understanding of man. Bronofsky is really worried about this backlash against science and reason that he saw beginning in the late 60s and that have taken over large parts of our society.
Wow, that is great. So you can get a book version of the documentary.
Yeah, which is
then
basically a transcript of the documentary.
Fabulous. Although we want people to read your book.
Yes.
The Ascent of Jacob Bronofsky, available where fine books are traded, I assume. Tim the lawyer, Tim Sandifer, Vice President for Litigation at the Goldwater Institute, a fan and co-host favorite for many, many moons, along with his delightful and brilliant bride. Good to talk to you, Tim.
I'll be talking about the book today in Sacramento, California. If you happen to be in town, go to timthelawyer.com to find information about it.
Absolutely fantastic. We got Marshall's news next. A couple of different polls have come out today we ought to take a look at, among other things, on the Armstrong and Getty Show.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.